Today is the day when we really begin in a systematic way our approach to long-term health care and other problems that in the health field that our committee has decided were really basic to any kind of attention we gave the subject. We have had forums in the last 6 to 9 months on the subject, but from now on it follows a definite outline. And before Dr. Weary, who has been chairing that committee, says anything, I want to just say a word about our speaker, Dr. Patricia Bamba. In planning this program and in contacting the officials at Rochester University, I asked the foolish question, do you think she, in addition to being an outstanding medical scientist, would be at home in leading discussions of the problem? And the answer was, she does it all the time. And that's for the benefit of all of us. Her career began at a smaller college where she graduated in pre-medical education, summa cum laude, and her record has been of that character consistently ever since. And now in approaching collaborative solutions to improving end-of-life care, we know that what she has to say will be just the kind of a subject that we thought should launch this series. And Dr. Weary, who will represent the committee in these discussions, has a few words to say.
Yes, thank you, Ken. Well, we're delighted that Dr. Bamba's here. She actually got her medical degree here at the University of Virginia, and I'm very pleased to say that her daughter Stephanie is a first-year medical student here at the university. So we are delighted to have you back in Charlottesville. She earned her degree in 1976, and she was also elected Alpha Omega Alpha, which is the honor society in medicine. And she's been at the University of Rochester since 1976. She is now the clinical assistant professor in medicine at the University of Rochester. She and also attending physician in medicine at Rochester General Hospital. She also is a program director in a seminar, I guess, or a seminar group entitled Enhancing the Management of Acute and Chronic Pain in Long-Term Care Facilities. And I think this is extremely important because one of the major problems, one of the reasons that there's been so much emphasis on things such as physician-assisted suicide and so forth, is that I don't think that many places, management of long-term of chronic pain and acute pain has been very good in long-term care facilities, and so it's very important that she's talking about those issues. She's also an expert and has written much and talked much on issues such as elder abuse and compassionate care. So we're delighted to have you here.
Thank you both. Thank you both, Dr. Weary and Mr. Thompson. It really is a pleasure to be with you, to be part of the aging series and public forums, and particularly to talk about the moral and legal issues surrounding end-of-life care. What I hope my comments will be this morning, they'll begin with basically a personal story that'll help provide the framework for much of the work that I've done. I then really want to be able to speak to you about what the state of dying is in America today, and then talk about some of the collaborative solutions that we've been doing in our community, being 45 counties in upstate New York. And then I will close and then open it up to discussion, because as my understanding is, that's really where we will get much of what will happen in this public forum today. We don't know when, we don't know how, but each and every one of us in this room today will die someday. But the question is this: will we die in the manner in which we've lived? Will our personal values, our spiritual beliefs, our cultural background be honored and respected? And will we be provided with dignity at the end of life? And I think the question each one of us needs to ask is, will people know what it is that we want at the end of life? And will those wishes be honored and respected? Death is a difficult subject for us to talk about, yet it's part of normal living, just as birth is. But it's much easier to talk about birth. Death can be a difficult subject. And in fact, death was really what brought me into medicine. I was 10 years old, and I can distinctly remember the first time I wanted to go to medical school. And it was actually leaving the cemetery when we buried my grandmother. I was 10 years old, and it was the perspective of a 10-year-old, but the care and the events surrounding her death and the aftermath showed me that there was much to be done to improve care at the end of life. You got to remember that this was a time when we didn't have hospice services, so I was actually blessed with being able to be a caregiver for my grandmother at the age of 10, and that impacted my life and impacted my choice of professional career. As Dr. Weary said, I came to the University of Virginia, and I was privileged to be here. And I had wonderful mentors, mentors like Dr. Ed Hook, the late Ed Hook, who was chair of medicine at the time, Dr. Weary, who was my mentor here, and I learned much about complex care of chronically ill patients and how to manage them. But in those days, University of Virginia was no different than any other medical school. We didn't talk about death. And so I became part of the established medical profession who said, basically, death is failure. And frankly, that was affirmed because 3 weeks before I completed medical school, my father died unexpectedly. And so it really thrust me into a residency where if people died, I just viewed it as I was a failure. And that's what our organized medicine really advocated back in those days. I began my post-residency career running an outpatient department. And 2 years into it, I was blessed to meet Dr. Frank Williams, who was at one point head of the National Institute on Aging. And he got me into geriatrics. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. And at that time, if you said you were in geriatrics, you said, Jerry what? Sometimes today, it's still Jerry what? And we became involved in doing geriatric consultation teams. And all of a sudden, I became the geriatrician. And we were trying to solve problems related to patients being in the hospital who should have not been in the hospital, but there were no available long-term care beds, and they weren't ready to go home. That really changed my career. I had hoped and had planned to come back actually to the University of Virginia and do a fellowship in hematology and oncology. But this work really changed my pathway. But yet I really didn't have a mentor in helping people to die, and I really was on this path of viewing death as failure. When I finished my 4 years in academic medicine and decided to open a private practice, my daughter was a toddler, my son was in diapers, and my husband was getting his MBA, so I had to come up with a plan for paying for diaper bills and the mortgage, just a few pragmatic things. And I began to work in long-term care as I was building my practice. And probably the most important mentor that I can speak of today is Lady Fern, and I want to tell you her story. Lady Fern was 85 years old, and several weeks after I started at the nursing home as both the medical director and the primary physician caring for patients there, she invited me to have tea. In those days, we didn't have assisted living. We had the equivalent called health-related facilities. And Lady Fern said to me, "We like what you're doing, but we've noticed one important thing. You can't talk about death. You can't face death." And what she told me was, "You can't be a good doctor unless you can do this." And so we had a conversation, and she said, "I want you to know I never want to go to the hospital. Take it from the framework that I just talked about." And I said, "But of course you want to go to the hospital. You could have a heart attack, a stroke." And I listed a whole number of medical conditions, and she said, "No, thank you." And I finally said, "But you could have a hip fracture, and you'd be in great pain. But of course you want to go to the hospital." And she wisely said to me, "What can you do for me here?" And I said, "Well, I can put you in what's said Buck's traction and stretch your hip, and I can give you morphine." And she said, "Why would you not offer that to me? Let's do that Buck's traction thing. Give me some morphine. If it doesn't work, we'll discuss it, and we'll come up with an alternative plan." And she was teaching me about goals of care and patient-centered care and really refocusing the decisions away from me as a physician. A few weeks later, I was called to her room, and she was having chest pain. She was clearly having a heart attack. I did an EKG, gave her oxygen, gave her nitroglycerin. Again, this is 25 years ago. We didn't have angiograms and all of the things we have today. And I said to her, "You're having a heart attack. You need to go to the hospital." And she wisely said to me, "Did we not have this conversation? Did I not teach you something?" And from the perspective of someone young and without a lot of experience, in 30 seconds, I thought, my medical career will be over. I have all these bills. I'll be on the front page of the city newspaper. And so I said, I will talk to her children. Her children came in and wisely taught me and asked me the question, "What does mother want?" I said, "She wants to stay here." Long and short of it, we transferred her to the skilled nursing facility. She did incredibly well. And the standard of care that she received in that nursing home was equivalent to what was being given to elderly 85-year-old women in London, England. She survived. She had no confusion from the transfer to the acute hospital setting. And when she came back to the health-related side, we birthed an ethics committee. And that ethics committee really was founded with patients and families, myself as physician, nurses, the administrators, people from the Episcopal diocese. And what we did was we said, we need to be able to talk to people about their wishes, and then we need to begin to set up a structure where we honor them. And we set up a rudimentary system of asking people, would you like to go to the hospital and have whatever level of care is available? Would you like to go to the hospital but not be in intensive care? Would you like to remain in the nursing home and have the level of support that we can offer you? Or would you want comfort care? The term palliative care didn't exist in those days. This was 9 years before the Patient Self-Determination Act. And that is why I share that story, because in terms of moral and ethical decisions at the end of life, Lady Fern was my greatest mentor. And my patients who came after, who I was privileged to help care for at the end of life, added to that mentoring experience. And she took away what she saw in me, which was the inability to face death. As I finished my career in my private practice and chose to come to my new position at Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield, I'm still in medicine, and I still say I'm in practice, but I'm in community practice. And what I like to be able to do is take some of what I've learned in clinical medicine, not only from the evidence that we've seen in the literature, but what we've learned from taking care of patients, and bring that forward. I was privileged to be able to hear the dean of the medical school this weekend talk about what the important characteristics were for the physicians of the future, and he spoke about humanism. And that's an essential element as we care for people at the end of life. Let's talk now about what is happening to the state of dying in America today. Think back to 1900, when the average life expectancy was 46, and people typically died at home. 100 years later, the average life expectancy is 76. Surveys show that 80% of Americans would prefer to die at home, yet 75% of Americans die in institutions, either in hospitals or nursing homes. So the question is, why is that? We've had remarkable strides in public health and sanitation, the birth of antibiotics. We've also had tremendous advances in science and technology. In the 60s, we had the birth of life-sustaining treatments, resuscitation, dialysis, and with it, the birth of significant ethical and moral dilemmas. But as we've had these advances, we've also had some changes in society. What do we value? We value youth. We value independence. We devalue aging. We devalue family and interdependent caring. And we have set up in our society an expectation that we can cure everything. But if you really look at modern healthcare, we cure very few things. But we really need to manage chronic illness. And as we look at it, each set of illnesses has a different type of natural history, which means it progresses differently. We've made tremendous strides in cancer. And so while we see a steady decline in health status or function, people do tremendously well. And the time between the end of what we can manage to give in terms of curative therapy and what people can see in terms of dying tends to be a very short phase. And it's expected. And that was the basis for developing the hospice Medicare benefit. Because the hospice Medicare benefit lasts for 6 months. And the average life expectancy between the end of someone with cancer and their demise tends to be about 2 months. But now we have an elderly population with chronic congestive heart failure and chronic obstructive lung disease. And we have an increasing aging population with dementia. And fortunately, people who are living well, but generally as they get older, they have frailty. And although we need to continue to look towards wellness in the elderly and really to advocate in a much greater way, we have a population of individuals who don't have perhaps one illness, but they have multiple illnesses. And as we look to the future and see what are we going to be dealing with, we have a rising epidemic of obesity, which is related in point of fact to heart disease and so many other risk factors for problems. So all of that needs to come into play when we begin to think of how do we manage end-of-life care. Because when we think of chronic heart failure and chronic lung disease, so often it's a much slower decline. And what we see is people have intermittent hospitalizations for acute exacerbations of these problems. And sometimes what happens is ultimately with one of these exacerbations, people suddenly die. It may have been that their heart could not tolerate their pneumonia or whatever. And what we see with dementia and general frailty, it's a much longer, slow decline in terms of health status and function over many, many years before people die. And as we begin to frame policy, we need to keep this into account. What do we know about care at the end of life? The largest study that looked at end-of-life care in hospitals was really funded in the early 90s by Robert Wood Johnson, and it's called the SUPPORT study. And it was a study to understand patient preferences and prognosis. And it was done with 5 major teaching institutions and over 9,000 patients. And during the first 2 years, the study looked at what were the characteristics of people dying. And that cadre of patients had a 47% mortality rate, which meant that one out of two were going to die within a six-month period of time. That mirrored what Medicare had set up as the hospice Medicare benefit. And for 2 years, they studied the medical records, and they talked to patients. They spoke to families to try to understand is what could define a good death and what were the characteristics. The next 2 years, they decided to define some interventions, some things that could make a difference. And they had three different characteristics in terms of the interventions. The first was they told the physicians what the prognosis was, what the chance was that someone would die, and also what the person's expectations were. The second were, what were the patient's preferences? And physicians were told, this is what the patient prefers, and this is their advanced care directive. And the third intervention was they brought together a nurse educator to help facilitate communications between providers, healthcare professionals, the patients, and families. And in the first 2 years, what they found in that study was that where people found do not resuscitate orders was really important. They defined unreasonable hospital days as those days when people were on ventilators and they were terminally ill. They looked at the cost of care, and they looked at what pain management was like as one of the indicators for both pain and symptom management, whether it's shortness of breath, fatigue, weakness. And then in those second 2 years, they looked at those interventions, and what they found was that none of those interventions made any difference. And those were five top hospitals in our country with the best medical care, the best medical education that we could offer. So the question is, what is happening in the rest of the hospitals in our large country? And the question is, where do we go from here? 2 years later, the Institute of Medicine issued a report on approaching death and looked at what were the quality indicators, what were the things that would help define what is a good death. And they looked at four different areas. Where was the site of death? And did it really honor what people wanted? Did they die at home if that's what their preference was? The second was, were advanced care directives done? Was that planning process done? And were those wishes communicated, discussed with providers, and ultimately honored? The third area had to do with pain management. And were people getting adequate pain management? And the last had to do with hospice referrals. Were they being referred to hospice? And if so, what was the length of stay? How long were they on hospice? And was it a very short length of stay? Because what we are finding in our country is that up to 40% of individuals get referred to hospice that have less than 1 week on hospice. And as you begin to think about what has to happen when people are coming towards the end of life, they need time to close their life, to heal relationships. And if you begin to think of that in larger terms beyond the medical care, 1 week is not very much time. I'd like to shift gears now in terms of what are we doing in our community. A group of physicians heard Don Berwick, who was the head of the Institute of Medicine and who wrote the report at the American College of Physicians. And we decided that we needed to look in our own community and to come up with community solutions. And so we devised a professional advisory group, and it embraced community physicians, and at that point I was a community physician. Physicians from the health plan, from the independent physicians organizations, the IPAs, as well as individuals from the hospice organizations, nurses from the medical school. And what we decided that we needed to do was to really look at our own community and to see what was happening in our community. Were we mirroring the national average in terms of the statistics? Were we doing better? Were we doing worse? So we conducted a community-wide survey in the fall of 2000. And what we found is that in Rochester, we were no better than the rest of the country. And we weren't really doing well in terms of advanced care planning. And in particularly, we looked at people
who were getting home care, and we divided up the individuals, and it didn't really make much difference whether they had chronic heart failure, chronic lung failure, Alzheimer's dementia and other dementias, or cancer. We also found that pain was not being assessed and managed across the continuum of care. The Joint Commission in January of 2001 had said all hospitals need to assess pain in individuals. They need to measure it as a fifth vital sign. They need to see pain just as important as blood pressure and pulse and temperature and respirations. And when you measure those, it commits you to doing something about it. And what we said is we wanted to look across the continuum. Long-term care facilities were not adequately following pain. Our home care institutions were not. The only systems that were really evaluating and managing pain was really hospice. We also looked at hospice referrals, and we found that in 98 and 99, 40% of people referred to hospice in our community had less than 1 week on hospice. And so with that information, we embarked on a community initiative, and much of what we have done has been based in the community initiative in Rochester, but we've taken the information to spread it to all 45 counties. And the community initiative that we brought together included all of our hospital systems, the major insurers, healthcare professionals, including physicians and nurses, social workers. We included educators, and we included consumers. We also included our spiritual leaders, so we had the bishops of the two major dioceses in our area. We had a rabbi, we also have an imam on our group. In total, we have more than 150 professionals and consumers trying to work together to say, what are community solutions? Because we recognized as health professionals, we didn't have all the answers. And in our group, we have an advisory group and we have four work groups. And we set about to look at the quality indicators, and we set about to say, how can we improve the completion rate of advanced care directors, advanced care directives, but also help individuals to understand it's not a piece of paper, but it's a planning process. We also then looked at one group saying, if we have these, how can we ensure that they will be honored, that the information will transition from one site of care to another, from nursing home to hospital, back to home. And the third was to say, we need to do better on pain, as well as other symptoms, and also do better in terms of supporting patients and families. And the last work group was on education and communication. And we decided we needed to launch concrete projects because we could talk forever about the importance of these issues. And so what we did in terms of the first work group is we began to have an advanced care planning campaign. And in doing so, we gathered information from the medical literature, and we began to talk to consumers, and we piloted two things. We wrote a booklet and we published it, and through the assistance from Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield, we have distributed over 100,000 of these booklets throughout upstate New York. The booklets show more than New York State specific forms. It really looks at advanced care planning as a process, one in which we need to help people to understand they need to explore their values and beliefs. They need to understand how to choose the right spokesperson. They need to understand the importance of communicating that information with family and healthcare providers, not just in terms of providing a document, but also to say, this is what I want at this phase in my life. Exactly what Lady Fern taught me 25 years ago. We then talk about the importance of completing the document, but also reviewing and updating it on a regular basis, because what people want may change over time. In trying to get the information to the public in a written format is one way. We've also developed a workshop called Community Conversations on Compassionate Care. Recognizing that if we only looked at an outcome measure, can we complete a document, that would not be sufficient, because people go through a process. People first need to be educated about what an advance directive is. Secondly, people have barriers as to why they haven't completed it. Those barriers need to be identified and they need to be eliminated. We then need to get people motivated to complete the document, have those conversations and discussions. Ultimately, stage 4, to do it, and 5 is to review and update it. Those stages are based in behavioral readiness research, and that stages were put together in collaboration by myself and Dr. Andy Doniger, who is the head of the Monroe County Health Department. And we've developed this tool, and we're measuring the impact of the workshops we developed and as we go out to the community, see if we can get people to move along that timeline. In the second group, we've developed a form called MOLST. MOLST is the Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatments. It's based on POLST, Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. I described the rudimentary form that we developed in the nursing home where I was the medical director 20 years ago. POLST in Oregon developed a much more elaborate form, and they developed it 12 years ago. And they have been using it throughout the institutions and trying to advocate for its use throughout the country. We live in New York State, the land of regulations, and we have much that needed to be incorporated into this form. And for the last 2 years, we've had a work group of healthcare professionals and consumers working to develop this form. It's being launched now in the community, and we have 2 major systems that have adopted it, as well as 80% of the nursing homes. That implementation will be going underway this fall and into the next years. We then developed the principles of pain management. This group was much larger than the community group I spoke to. The community group worked on the patient-related information that could be disseminated to all of our communities. We had a separate work group that really worked on developing basic principles and putting them in a format that our providers have come to understand. And that's on one simple piece of paper. And so what we did was try to come up with basic principles of assessment and management on one side of the paper and all of the medications that we may want to use on the other side. We brought together a 28-person group from across all of upstate New York, including not only physicians and nurses, but also psychologists and complementary medicine providers. And we developed these beyond palliative care and beyond end of life and looked at basic principles that would be appropriate from cradle to grave and deal with both acute pain management and chronic pain management as well as palliative care. We distributed information that supported that one single page. We developed a guide for children, and we put a 26-page booklet together with resources and developed or distributed nearly 20,000 throughout upstate New York and developed a toolkit, which we've distributed this year. We've developed educational forums for community providers as part of that initiative in collaboration with long-term care providers, developed a syllabus that we could use for long-term care. And finally, we developed a website for the community and did not really replicate education because on a separate piece, Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield was basically hosting the education for physicians on end-of-life care, which is a major syllabus that has been developed to help bridge the educational gap for educating providers. And we began to launch that simultaneous with this community initiative in the Syracuse region, and we have replicated that now 4 times, 4 different regions of upstate New York, and our 5th 3-day conference will be hosted in 3 weeks here in Rochester. 2 other very brief initiatives, and then I'd like to open it up. One of the major barriers has been basically reimbursement of providers. In collaboration with our IPA, we've developed a model for reimbursing physicians who provide palliative care. That started in the Rochester region, and that has helped to launch more palliative care consultation teams in hospital systems. And we hope now to launch that across all of our regions. There aren't certification for palliative care specialists. It's kind of where geriatrics was when I started because there weren't fellowships. And so we have had to develop some interim certification, and we now hope to pattern that across all of our regions. And finally, we've developed a program on pediatric palliative care, which is a case management program that begins to look at some of the financing gap for some of the needs that families have in delivering palliative care to children with advanced chronic illness. Because families who are grappling with these issues for children who are dying have to worry about their other siblings. They have to worry about the children who have chemotherapy and need wigs. They need some other support for the family members. So it's a case management program that helps to provide these other resources that are typically not provided with insurance coverage. So with that, I'd like to just close by saying life is a story. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and the end. And each of us in this room need to think about who will write our final chapter. And again, I ask the question, will the way we die be consistent with the way we live? And will it be based on our own personal values? Will it respect our personal values, our spiritual beliefs, our cultural background? And will we die with dignity? Thank you.
Who would like to begin the discussion? Dr. Weary.
I have two questions for you. There's a recent article about the the six-month limit on hospice care. And the author of the article commented about the fact that it's very difficult for physicians to really determine when a patient is going to die, and we all know that. And that the limitation of 6 months may be turning a number of people away, or physicians away, from putting their patients into hospice care because they simply feel uncomfortable about making that kind of commitment. So my question there is there reason to reconsider the 6 month termination time? The other question is, why do you think that physicians have been so reluctant to use adequate pain management? Is it because they're worried about being accused of overusing narcotics and so forth? Or is there some reason to begin to think about how to correct that sort of problem? So those are two questions.
I think that, first of all, they're two excellent questions. First, in terms of the hospice Medicare benefit, there's real differences between hospice and palliative care in terms of how it's defined. With hospice care, there are two major things that a physician needs to do. A physician needs to be able to certify that the patient will die within a six-month period of time. And the differences in terms of those natural histories that I alluded to, but I didn't show graphs, really adds to the difficulty in terms of prognosis. I also think some of the difficulty comes from the difficulty in talking about death. And I say that because as we look at individuals who have heart failure, and we watch their ejection fraction coming from 40%, or the heart's working at a 40% down to 5%, we know people are heading towards death. But the clear second reason, I think, is also important. And that's because individuals must say, I give up any desire for any other curative measures. So I think that is the second essential element besides the difficulty with prognosis, because you can see that people are heading towards the end and you can begin to have discussions with them, particularly after they've had interventions. They may have been on a respirator, and you need to have conversations about what is your goal for treatment now and would you do it again. But this second component about giving up any other attempt is, I think, from a consumer perspective, another barrier. In terms of how we define it, the most clear-cut, up-to-date in definition of palliative care is really interdisciplinary care that is directed to reducing suffering and improving the quality of life for patients with advanced chronic illness. That definition is basically the type of care that hospice provides. It also speaks for integrating spiritual and psychological support, something that hospice has done for a long time. The key, though, has been really allowing that type of care to be continued while you still provide for other interventional care. I think it's a double-edged sword. It's not just the physician's prognosis, it's this other barrier that exists. In terms of barriers for effective pain management for providers, I think they're multiple. And as we looked to embarking on our project, Principles of Pain Management, we found that physicians were indeed afraid of prescribing. But physicians really didn't understand well the fact that you can prescribe as long as there's adequate documentation. I think increasingly societies, the Society of Federation for Medical Societies, have really looked to say you can prescribe these drugs as long as there's adequate documentation, that you have assessed the patient, it's the right patient that needs this treatment, and they've been managed appropriately, they've been reassessed. And there's documentation. And there's a look to see, is there the potential for aberrant behavior? Is there the potential for addiction? So I think that's one barrier. But I think there's also another major barrier, and that's a lack of education on the part of providers. As part of that project that we did, we developed a standardized educational grand rounds that could be provided to all different subspecialists as well as provided in the community. And we asked physicians questions, physicians and physician extenders. Some basic information on opioid pharmacology is just not known. And part of our attempt was to make people comfortable that they could understand the correct medications and the correct assessment and choose the right drug for the right patient at the right time. So I think educational barriers exist for the providers. Educational barriers exist for the community as well. There are barriers among patients. Patients have misconceptions about medications, particularly in the elderly, which is a group that is undertreated. You can look at any survey. But many times the elderly fear talking about pain because they fear that they will end up with diagnostic studies that they don't want. They fear they'll end up in the hospital and perhaps lose their independence. They fear that if they use medications early, that when they really need it, it will not be effective. And so proper education of the patient is also critical. So I think there's multiple barriers. Those are just a few of the barriers to effective pain management, but I think we need to educate providers and some basic principles as we do this that can be used not only at end of life but throughout the practice of medicine.
Peter Chapin.
Some of those barriers cease to exist once hospice comes in. I ask because my mother went through chronic pain for years under care of two doctors, and as soon as hospice came in, within a week or so, they had her pain-free, and her life has changed.
And I think that is the point I was getting at in terms of the need to bridge the educational gap for professionals. Hospice has done a wonderful job on pain, and they know how to do it. Some of the barriers from providers are they are not clear on how to do it. They're afraid of doing it. They're afraid of reprisals. And so we really need to help people to know how to use the medications in a better way and also provide expertise for physicians who are not comfortable or where the pain is not adequately controlled, even if they know basic approaches in terms of assessment and management. And I'll give you an example. We should not be trying to educate every physician to appropriately use methadone. Methadone is a very difficult drug to use. There are some experts in pain management or palliative care experts who can much better do it. And so on a global educational venue, we have people understand there are some difficult drugs. Don't try to do it yourself. Get help from people who are experts. But I think it really affirms, your story affirms why we are doing this educational program in terms of pain management. Because it really not only applies to end of life, but it also applies to those individuals who are managing chronic headaches, chronic low back pain. It's estimated on an annualized basis that $8 billion is being expended by industry for people who are not elderly, but in the working population. And much of that is due to ineffective pain management and not because of work-related events, but more related to chronic back pain and some of the other things, or pain that's associated with other chronic illnesses.
Dr. Muller.
I wanted to comment on what kind of experience you've had with how well advanced directives are followed at the end of life. A lot of people, more and more, are having them, but then at the time end of life comes, how effective have they been in having their wishes carried out?
I think it's a major gap. In the Institute of Medicine report, basically, wishes were not honored. As you look at the experience with POLST and the Oregon experience for the past 12 years, they have done much better, and they have begun to publish studies, and there will be some that will be published in the next few weeks. I was privileged to hear Patrick Dunn 2 weeks ago, who was head of the Oregon Task Force, and it truly is focusing the educational efforts and developing a systematic form. The POLST form is a singular form. It's a colored form. It tends to be bright pink, and it travels with the patient. And it's not an advanced directive, but rather a medical orders for life-sustaining treatment that basically says, at this point in time, I do not wish to be resuscitated, I do not wish to have antibiotics, or I wish to have antibiotics, but it's a physician order form. It may be completed when someone is in a hospital. Patient then goes to the nursing home. That form then travels to the nursing home. Patient may have rehab, say, for instance, for a hip fracture, then goes home on home health care. That form travels with the individual and then stays in the home. They're not honored now, and we need a better system. POLST has just been given a huge grant to see if we can propagate that whole idea throughout the country. The state of West Virginia has begun to look at it. The state of Michigan has begun to do it. And I think it's an important, it's equally important as doing advanced directives. I think it also underscores the importance of communication. Because if you just do a form and you don't have communication with the provider and with family, it really sets up the dilemmas that we see in institutions where ethics teams need to come in. And I think much can be done if you talk ahead of time. As an example, you've done your advanced directive. It may be that your provider does not believe or has a different set of spiritual beliefs and finds they are not able to manage what you want. The time for that to be established is not when you're sitting in the ICU and you're not able to speak for yourself and where your family is not aware of what you want. So we need to have active conversation, and is when those medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, those decisions have been made, they need to be documented. And we need to assure that there's good transition of that information through the continuum of care. It's not happening today.
Reverend Poyce.
You made reference there at the last moment about family not knowing. But you haven't said very much about the role of surrogate decision makers and where they enter into this whole process. I wonder if you had some comments about their importance or how they should be determined or what?
That's an important aspect of the advanced care planning process. And one needs to know how to choose the right spokesperson. And depending on what state you're in, it may be called something different, the durable power of attorney, or for healthcare, in our state, it's the agent. First, it needs to be someone who knows you well, who understands you, understands your values, understands what's important to you. It also needs to be an individual who is willing to talk to you now about tough issues. And needs to be able to be someone who can be an advocate, who understands how to deal with conflict, needs to be able to be an advocate and speak both to the rest of the family as well as to the team of healthcare providers. And so those need to be chosen appropriately. Too often people say, well, I guess I need to choose my spouse, because otherwise they would feel badly. But if spouse will have difficulty making those decisions and does not have the skill set to be able to advocate and have those discussions, it may not be the correct person.
Other questions? Yes, please.
How does one go about seeing a geriatric specialist? Do you need a referral from a certain doctor? Do you become a certain age? Where do we find these people?
Well, that is a very difficult question, because I think we have, and we'll have even more as our population ages, a manpower shortage, and not one that we've really talked about. And currently, in my current position, I get calls all the time asking for geriatricians in all different parts of upstate New York. And unfortunately, the way our systems have been set up, many of our trained geriatricians are working in systems. And I'll speak to certainly my community, and I can't speak for all of the country. But many of the trained geriatricians are involved in care, in long-term care, continuum of care. And so they may be providing care to people in nursing homes, perhaps assisted living. In my work as a geriatrician, because of my work on the geriatric consultation team, I was always getting the referrals for patients who were complicated. My practice was closed after the first 6 months for myself and my associate, who was also geriatric trained. And so it becomes very difficult, I think, for the consumer to get it. Consumers don't necessarily need referrals in terms of the thought of referrals when you're thinking of a managed care population, but in terms of referrals to be able to get the type of care you may want, it may have to be a physician to a physician saying this person needs a geriatrician. What I'm hearing more and more, though, is everyone wants to see a geriatrician. And I think that what we need to do, and this is another forum, I think, it's really where do we go with geriatric education across the continuum, both for family providers and internists, and what can well-trained internal medicine physicians and family practitioners do for geriatrics, and what types of problems need to be referred to the current geriatricians. Problems like geriatric syndromes, people where you may be suspecting abuse. There may be a problem with gait abnormalities and urinary incontinence. I don't see in the immediate, with looking at manpower, that every older person will see a geriatrician. But I also see a need for education for certain providers to be trained in the way I was trained at UVA so many years ago, which is learn how to take care of complicated, complex illness, focus on geriatric problems, and be the referral source. Because I think in our country what's happening now is we have cardiologists looking at the heart, we have pulmonary specialists looking at the lungs, and we need to have more people looking at the person and balancing the consultation and the benefits and burden that the cardiologist may be seeing from their perspective with what we see from the pulmonologist standpoint. In my practice, I always said I'm the captain of the ship. I need to balance both and kind of be the barrier between the patient and the rest of the team and help to weigh it, because we have guidelines for each individual disease, but you have to blend them together for some of the complex elderly that we see.
Bo Anthony.
We have a political climate and a judicial climate that takes the divine spirit, if you will, and regulates it out of our schools and out of our Pledge of Allegiance and other ways. At their convenience, they re-regulated the divine spirit back into the laws that prohibit physician-assisted suicide. The medical profession operates under a Hippocratic oath, which says do no harm. That is an oath that the medical profession has taken, and it is a prism which the patient may not be viewing the same problem as. And until, it seems to me, the medical profession can get behind a true discussion of physician-assisted suicide, they're going to have to put aside the Hippocratic Oath in some sense, I suppose. But the end of life, in terms of how you described it, is all on manageable terms. There are some patients, and all of us in this room, I fear, are troubled by those circumstances that may be absolutely beyond anything that we say culturally you want to protect, and you want to have the wishes of the patient adhered to and heard. Many of us are going to find ourselves in the position where you want to be heard, and nobody's going to do anything. And I wonder what you can do about the physician-assisted suicide, or if you think that that is something that's not on the table or shouldn't be on the table.
Since the question is directed to physician-assisted suicide, I know you have a whole forum coming up later in the fall that will be directed. You'll be hearing from Tim Quill, who actually trained with me at the University of Rochester. What I will say, and I think that the whole debate should really be focused during that hour forum, but I can say from my own personal experience that I cared for many people who were card-carrying members of the Hemlock Society. And what we did was had conversation and said, from my personal perspective, I cannot basically advocate for physician-assisted suicide, but I can make you of five promises, which was the promise that I gave all individuals. One, when the time comes when there's nothing further we can do in terms of curative measures, I will let you know. I will be honest. The second promise I made is that I will be with you. I will not abandon you. And in my 25 plus years of experience, that is incredibly important to patients. Patients fear abandonment. And in the way our healthcare delivery system has evolved, too often the person who's in the primary relationship may not be there and the patient may feel abandoned. Third was adequate pain and symptom management. And in my experience, people fear not being treated for pain and fear that they will die in pain. The fourth is care for family and their friends to help them in the transition, because there is so much unresolved issues at the end of life that demand some closure, oftentimes related to some dysfunction in the family or some issues that have to be resolved before end of life. And the last is, I will talk to you about hospice when it's appropriate. And letting people know that the old adage, there's nothing to be done, is not true. That when you cross the barrier and you go into treatment that are really focused on palliation, reducing suffering and improving quality of life, that there are aggressive measures, and that there is science to pain management that can be utilized not just at the end, but through that continuum where you're treating and managing their advanced chronic illness. My experience has been that when people know that, even when they've come to the end, that's what they've asked for. And many individuals are depressed, and we need to look at that. The most vivid recollection that I had was the 98-year-old who was caring for her 94-year-old sister at the end of life. She had chronic kidney disease, and she wanted her sister to die at home. Both were card-carrying members of the Hemlock Society. And so the challenge for me was to tell the hospice organization that this 98-year-old woman could be the primary caregiver, which is another important kind of qualifier that physicians need to meet. You need to have someone that agrees to be that primary caregiver. We ultimately were able to convince hospice, because I got a backup nephew that I found in the community. But ultimately, through that caring for that individual, what I found in talking to her, that those were her fears. And this, too, was early in my practice. And it really did pattern as I had discussions with other individuals. It's really trying to make sure you're providing for people. It's not always easy, and it takes a lot of time. And Medicare does not necessarily, in our current reimbursement methodology, reimburse appropriately for that type of time, nor for the palliation without some of the barriers for hospice reimbursement. So the other issues, I think you can expand with Tim when you talk about physician-assisted suicide, but I think you need to frame it with knowing that we are not providing some basic things for patients that patients want.
We've come to our normal adjournment time. There are three of you who have questions to ask. Why don't we compromise on one? And Larry, do you want to just ask the final question?
One, would you be my primary care physician?
I sense that much of what you say goes against the curse of what we currently face systemically between insurers, the specialization of medicine, as you indicated, and that my quip about would you be my primary care physician, what was really a sincere one, notwithstanding that it's a house call from Rochester to Charlottesville, but we'll talk about that. I don't know how the lady who asked about how do I find a geriatrician? How do we cope with the real world of managed care, the real world of insurance companies, the real world of hospital systems with practices that are chopped into segments that are so precise that I don't know if any doctor ever can get his or her arms around the whole person. And I certainly, in my own experience, and you know, knock wood, I've been healthy as my family has been, the constant rotation of doctors. I'm new in the community, as one can tell from my southern accent, that my primary care physician would not take care of me if I was admitted to the hospital. There's another kind of physician that takes care of one in the hospital. So how does one, I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but how does one transfer the very personal care that you've identified to my case where my doctor doesn't even come to the hospital to see me? Who's going to be with me at the end?
And I think that was one of the barriers that I spoke to earlier in terms of people not being there and feeling abandoned, and that's the precise example. I don't think I have an easy answer to that in the very short time that we have remaining, but I can, I guess as I see down the pathway, what we've tried to do with our community initiative has been really to engage insurers, and in fact, and it may be the difference because the insurance company that I work for now is the medical director for geriatrics, is a not-for-profit, and part of the strategic goal is to make a difference in the community. And so what we're trying to do is engage insurers in this whole community initiative so that we begin to come up with collaborative solutions. What we haven't engaged is Medicare. And that is the more difficult dilemma, and that is a whole other forum presentation. How do we begin to make changes in the reimbursement methodology? And I think that some of that can become leadership from the Blues organizations. And so much of the initiatives that I outlined in very, very abbreviated terms, we've brought to the Blue Cross Association so that as that organization nationally raised the importance of palliative care so that we can begin to get some structure there, even if Medicare is not moving in that direction. And yet they are, because physicians can bill for palliative care under Medicare reimbursement methodology. So if we can begin even on the private side to come up with some creative solutions that can go even from the little upstate New York to the national level and begin to be modeled. I think that's one step. We had our association, Blue Cross Blue Shield Association meeting last week in Chicago. We were able to present our program on principles of pain management, and other plans have talked to us about how can we begin to adapt that and really begin to break down some of the barriers that we've talked about this morning in terms of people not getting adequate pain. They have a Best of Blues Awards. There were 116 submissions from across the country. 8 awards. We didn't get one, but our community-wide end-of-life palliative care initiatives and separately Compassionate, the pediatric palliative care, were highlighted as honorable mention. And that information in terms of what has been included is disseminated in CDs to all of the plans across the country. So I think it has to be a collaborative. There's not a, on a personal, individual level, docs can't provide all of this care. It's a team approach. It's what I learned in geriatrics. It's what I learned in long-term care. We need to work in collaboration with other healthcare professionals and patients and families.
Two sentences, Charlie Smith, only two.
It's going to be hard. I would say it's interesting that you mentioned mental, in line with Bo Hopkins' comment about Hippocrates, that you mentioned mentor, who was the only person to whom Odysseus was willing to entrust the education of his son. And in a way, it seems to summarize the things when you say that you have talked about your mentor, one of whom is here today in Peyton Weary, and the other mentors that you mentioned in the early part of your conversation. And they have led you to a good understanding of the need to be not just a follower of Hippocrates, but also a follower of mentor.
Thank you.
Well, we're 7 minutes over, which we normally don't do, but this series is one of the most remarkable, I think, that has ever been held at the center, because not a subject was mentioned this morning that in one way or another is not discussed in one or more of the other events that are going to occur. So we hope all of you will be sufficiently touched by what we've heard, that you want to hear more, and that you'll come back and be with us in the future.